Welcome to the Authors Connection Show. I'm your host, Susan Klaus.
And we're back with the Authors Connection, coming to you from beautiful Sarasota, Florida, the heart of the Sun Coast. And we're here at our new location, Circle Books, on St. Armand Circle. And with me, I have what every mom needs to listen to today. And that is, we have author Deborah M. Cody. And one of her books is called Mom Needs Chocolate. And if that doesn't get you going, ladies, you don't know what it is. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you so much, Joe. Nice to be here.
You're very welcome. Why don't you tell our audience a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a poster child for It's Never Too Late to Chase Your Dreams. I was an occupational therapist specializing in orthopedics for 32 years now. And about, it's been 8 years ago now, at the age of 45, I was sitting in a dentist office pondering what to do with my life now that my youngest chick was about to fly the coop. And I was suddenly struck by the idea of writing. I had always wanted to. It was a childhood dream of mine, but that got backburnered, as life often does to us. Went off in the direction of science rather than English and literature. And all those years later, fast forward 30 years, and I felt like it was time to start writing. So I became a student, I guess, again, after all those years. And I took some crash courses in all kinds of things, grammar, punctuation, how to different writing styles. And I started writing, first of all, magazine articles. And I was really, truly blessed to have a mentor. She was a friend of a friend of a friend who had had some publishing experience in my chosen genre, which was inspirational. And so she met with me monthly at a Barnes & Noble, and we had lattes together. And she kind of coached me a little bit. And largely because of her influence, I was able to have 10 magazine articles published that first year, which I didn't know was a big deal until I started going to writers' conferences and met people who had been working on it for 30 years and hadn't had that many. So it was truly, truly a blessing. I call it a God thing. And so then that led to I have a newspaper article that I write now monthly, and I've been doing that about 5 years now. And then that led to books. And I thought, hey, the mountain's there. I want to see if I can climb it. So I started with, of all things, fiction, which people say, what? You did it backwards. But I wrote two novels. Those did very well. And then I went on, that was with a small press. And then I went on to writing. Now I'm pretty much doing inspirational humor for women. And I'm on book number 14. It's just been a wild journey.
So let's go back to your younger days. Actually, a two-part question. The first part that I think is important is, did you have somebody encourage you to write or read a lot when you were growing up?
Well, I was what I call a rabid reader. I foamed at the mouth to get those books. I read everything I could get my hands on, any genre, any age range. And I was very, very influenced by the book Christie by Catherine Marshall. As a teenager, I read it 9 times, and it changed my life. It changed my faith. It changed the way I looked at everything, and it planted in me a seed that maybe one day I could maybe write a book that would touch other young hearts just the way Christie touched mine. And that's pretty much what my first novel was. My first novel is called The Distant Shore, and it's about a young girl, and it's kind of a Christie meets Anna Green Gables, you know. And I've had the most amazing letters from people who say that it definitely had changed their lives in ways I never anticipated.
Let's fast forward a little bit to the chicks that you had that have left since then.
Mm-hmm.
Did you read a lot to them as well?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. In the womb and beyond. And in fact, I'm expecting my first grandbaby. Sure, you jot down all the things that they say that cracks you up, because other people will identify with that. It'll crack them up. And you'll end up with a book like I did when My Mom Needs Chocolate. It's basically a diary of my life with my children.
Going back to the reason for writing that book, we live in a really turbulent world, and it has been for a few years now. Did you just one day said, you know, I got to help these people. I got to help moms here. They really do need some help. Or was it something that you've been planning to do years before that?
No, I really wasn't planning that, but I speak. I'm a speaker as well. And when I speak to women's groups and when I'm around different, you know, organizations and things where I associate, I'm an avid tennis player, too. I'm a tennis addict. And I have a lot of that's a whole subculture people don't even know about. But there's a lot of women that I meet and greet there. And I began to hear them talking about needing hope. And they just needed to know that that motherhood tunnel had a light at the end of it. Because when you're in it, when you're in what I call the joy-sucking dully funks, and you're just immersed in the muck and the mud of motherhood, you can't see. You don't have that hope. You can't get your eyes above onto the horizon. So my goal with Mom Needs Chocolate was to help encourage women to know that they can make it out alive and that their faith can, in fact, not only be intact, but better and stronger than it ever was before.
So when you were talking about Mom Needs Chocolate, is there a certain age group that you're looking at, or is it even for grandmas?
It is. It's for everyone, moms, from pregnancy through menopause. And I have chapters for everybody.
So when you start writing that, I mean, do you focus on, you were talking about the different chapters, do you focus on problems to put a little humor on the issues of today?
Absolutely. I'm all about laughing, choosing to laugh instead of cry, because so many things that you're in, of course, it's so absolutely barbaric that, and just impossible to believe, especially moms know all the situations that you end up in with your kids. You have to either laugh or cry, and it's your choice. And that is the premise for the book. I want to help people through scripture and through other people's experiences, including my own, to understand that you do have a choice there, and you don't have to be totally, snowed under by your circumstances.
Do you find that it's a little bit different writing for moms who are raising single?
Yes, and I try to be sensitive to that, because I know I've been married 32 years to the same long-suffering, poor man. And, you know, you do end up writing from the perspective of which you know. And so I've tried to include some experiences from other people that were single moms, and that so that I can be sensitive to that particular issue. Yeah.
How did you collect the information? I mean, did you actually meet with, like, single moms or things like that?
A lot of informal chatting. I call them chick chats. Mm-hmm. And as I said, I'm a speaker, so I love to go to new places and meet with women's groups or civic organizations or church groups, a lot of writers' groups. And during that time, you just kind of gather everybody's stories. And when there's one that really kind of piques your interest, you get back in touch with them.
Do you find that people are willing to provide you with that information, or do they hesitate and say, well, you're not going to put that in the book, are you?
Most of the time, they gladly want to share their experiences with others, because they want to help other people through similar circumstances. And, you know, I think that we women, not you, of course, although I'm sure you're in touch with your feminine side, but we women are what I call a slightly sagging sisterhood. And we can help each other up, and that's what I like to think. We gather strength from God, Godiva, and girlfriends. And that's my perspective. And so I think most women feel that if they can help somebody else through a problem that they have sifted through themselves, they're more than happy to do that. And occasionally people will say, could you please not use my name? And I'm always happy to change a name or to, you know, change some data so that it's not real apparent who it is.
So a couple of different things come to mind as we're sitting here talking. One of them is, do you see a book, or maybe you can kind of explain how Mom Needs Chocolate to, let's say, something outside the United States. I mean, you know, there's countries out there where the moms are struggling as well.
Correct.
Do you feature those in the book, or do you?
Well, I don't really have a lot of international things in there, although I do have one situation that occurred when I was in Austria for a time, a funny story from there. But Mom Needs Chocolate is really kind of an analogy that is the underlying thought is that we need support and we need comfort. And like chocolate is a comfort food to us, and it settles us down and it meets those deep gut level needs. We need other things as well. We need, again, I mentioned the sisterhood. I think we need faith, and we just need companionship through this life.
So the chocolate companies really could use you as a spokesperson.
I actually had one that carried my books, and they supplied me with all kinds of chocolate. I had these things called chalkouts, and they were parties, and they were people could sponsor them, or churches or civic groups, and we would have, everybody would bring chocolate. We would have a big chocolate fountain and all kinds of great stuff to dip in there, and the whole thing was a chocolate theme for like an hour and a half, and we had chocolate games, and we just had all kinds of talk with each other, chick-chat again, and this chocolate company would give us these huge trays of the most outrageously good chocolate. So, yeah, some of them were smart enough to tune in on that.
Okay, so I've got to ask you this because, you know, as we're leaning toward moms, how about the dads?
Funny you should ask.
Okay.
I get letters from dads who say, my wife left, mom needs chocolate in our bathroom because, you know, now I'm a potty writer because I write these books with these little short chapters for women on the go, so where do you think they leave them? Well, the dads will say, you know, I love this book. I love the stories in this book because I love anecdotes. I keep a lot of great anecdotes. And they say, come on now, dad needs chocolate too. So maybe one day we'll do a dad needs chocolate.
What were some of the surprising things that happened to you as you were gathering information for the book? I mean, was there certain things that you thought, wow, I never thought of that?
Well, I always think that. Whenever I dig into a scripture, the premises in the book are based on scriptures, but I try to be real. Above all, I want to be real. And so I'm always surprised when I read a different translation of a scripture and it hits me in a brand new, fresh way. And so I try to do that. I use different translations on each chapter. And I do that with my upcoming books, too. I have one coming out in August that's based on a stress theme. And I do the same thing. I've looked up lots and lots of scriptures, and I try to, the point is to apply them to real life. And that's what faith's all about.
Yeah. It's interesting that, again, I don't know whether it's just the way, or maybe there is something to it, you know, the chocolate theme. You know, I see commercials, I see marketing ploys and stuff on television and newspapers like that, where chocolate seems to be the theme for a lot of different things, whether it's male or female. And yet, we're kids, we were told, you know, you can only have so much chocolate. So, how does that mom, even though it's there, how does she get back into being the kid? Because that's basically what we're talking about here, right?
Yep, the comfort factor.
Yeah.
Well, on a practical level, I lost 40 pounds from the time, this is ironic, that Mom Needs Chocolate was published, from the time I wrote it till the time it came out, which people don't realize it takes a year to 2 years usually when you have a traditionally published book. And during that time, I was a very tight 14. And I was just miserable with myself because I come from a family of little pygmies, really. They're all teeny little people. My granddaddy was 5 foot even, and all of his six daughters were less than that. So my mother and everybody, you know, you feel like you're a head taller than them, and I'm 5 foot two. So I was like a moose in my family. But still, I was a very large moose around the hips. So I really wanted to lose weight. So I made a Debbie Do-Over year, and I talk about that in my upcoming book. But anyway, I lost all this weight, and it's really funny. I was able to eat chocolate the entire time, which boggles people's mind because I don't like to call myself a chocoholic. I call myself a choco-athlete. Because, honey, I can do some marathons with that stuff. But I've learned the discipline involved. And instead of eating the whole bar, which is very easy for me to do, I set aside my three little squares. And that is my quota for the day. And if I stick to that, and, of course, weight loss is a matter of checks and balances. And I was a Weight Watchers. I was using their principles as well. And you're able to eat. You have a deprivation period of about, I guess it was about 6 weeks where you had none. You had to go cold turkey to get it out of your system and get that, you know, the primal urges under control. And then after that, ever since then, that's 3 years ago now, I've been able to eat chocolate every single day. And yes, it is maybe juvenile, but, you know, I see that thread connecting women all over the world and men too in a lot of instances. But.
Okay, so along that same line, I'm going to call you the scientist of chocolate. Is there a difference between that milk chocolate we get like in the Hershey's as opposed to the 90% cocoa bean that's in those other bars?
You bet.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I did some research on that, but basically, it tastes different, but there's different, they can do flavors in different chocolates now, which is amazing. You know, the dark chocolate, the beans themselves, the way they grow them, can taste differently. And I'm personally a Cadbury girl, and of course I love Godiva, but you can definitely tell difference, and the dark is actually better for you. You know, there's all kinds of now research to prove that, you know, it's actually good for you. But I'm really a milk chocolate girl, so I cheat, and I eat a little of the dark and a lot of the milk, which is not good. But.
So do you have a chart that says, if you're in this mood, have this level or something on that?
No,
level.
I don't, but what a great idea.
Well, it seems practical.
There are
certain things. I mean, you know, ice cream and chocolate.
Amen.
You know, one of the things that I get into myself is like Moose Tracks, where there's chunks of chocolate and stuff
I
like
love
that.
Moose Tracks.
But it's also a lot of vanilla, you know, whatever else they have in it. So I always wondered if there was ever a schedule that says, okay, besides the health fanatics, and I know that there's a lot of them out there, and, you know, whether, okay, if I'm really having a bad day, do I want the 90% cocoa? Is that going to affect me more? And as they're saying now, it does.
It does. I believe it does.
How about like hot chocolate? I mean, anything is that?
Yeah.
One?
But you know what I found? This was part of my weight loss. I went from a 14 to a 2. And I would, every morning when I'd get the hungries about 10 o'clock, I would have, I think it's Publix, who puts out a very good sugar-free hot chocolate. It tastes just like the regular, and it will kill all the other impulses that you have to pig out. So I would have one of those at 10 o'clock every morning. Awesome.
Really? What about chocolate syrup, like in chocolate milk? I mean,
oh, they make sugar-free and fat-free, and it tastes like bleh, like cardboard, honestly.
Yeah.
And, you know, some fake foods are not bad, and some are just hideous. And
okay, so I've got to ask you this. You're talking about the fake foods and all the chocolates out there. According to some of those world-famous doctors that like to write things, basically tell us that, you know, too much sugar's not good for you in that sense, and you shouldn't have candy bar, and that sweeteners are better for you. But honestly, you know, being, you know, a chocolate lover myself, the point is I know, I can tell with one bite, it's like drinking a pop that's sweetened with something other than sugar.
Exactly.
Immediately, no.
And the aftertaste.
Doesn't that affect, I mean, in a sense, I know that sometimes people would think that chocolate is just like, oh, you got your lollipop. Or remember when you used to go to the dentist and they work on your teeth and you got an ice cream cone or whatever it
was?
It was something like that. But I really do think the chocolate mentality really does, as you were saying about, it puts you in a different mood.
It does.
And it is a food.
It's uplifting.
So does it matter if it's unsweetened chocolate? You know, like artificially sweetened.
I think
say.
It depends on your whole attitude. Like I would prefer to have the real thing, of course. And it probably does give you a little bigger buzz, to be truthful. But if you're willing to settle for a little bit less, then the artificial is where you have to go sometimes, you know, depending upon your goal. And mine was to lose weight.
I've seen you're looking for something in that book. So.
Yes, I have a couple of chapters, not only in Mom Needs Chocolate, but in my new book coming out called Too Blessed to Be Stressed, about chocolate and about eating. And I was looking, my chapter here in Mom Needs Chocolate is called A Sugar Addict in a Carbophobic World. And it touches on some of the very things we were just talking about, nutritional choices.
Do you find that when you're giving lectures, I mean, do people, when you talk to them, do you have to kind of pry them a little bit to get them involved, or do they just jump up and say, oh, yeah, go, girl?
Well, it's funny. When you get in front of some audiences, and I'm sure, Joe, you understand this very well, you'll get the arms crossed.
Exactly.
You'll get the steely eyes looking back at you. You get the body language saying, you're going to have to work for this, honey. You know, if you want me, you're going to have to come and get me. And then other times, you'll sit and you'll get this wonderful, open, arms-out feeling from your audience. And thankfully, usually it's the latter. Usually the women that I speak to they're there because they want a little boost, and they want a little jovialness, and they want that camaraderie. They're ready, and they're open, and they're wanting it. So usually I get a very, very nice welcome.
I know that when I do workshops myself, and I get up there, and you kind of walk out to the audience, and I understand exactly what you're saying, because you walk out, and you can feel it, and you say, I should have missed the plane to get here in the first place.
Yeah.
Because you could just feel that.
Oh, I have to tell you this one story. And, they're everywhere, but I was speaking to a church group, a women's church group in Orlando, about a year ago, and during the course of my speech, I mentioned about the weight loss. And, just mentioned it. And then at the end, the women come up and speak to you, very nice. And one woman was very well-dressed, probably in her early 60s, not a hair out of place, every sprig perfect, coiffed just wonderfully, and a very expensive outfit. And she came up and she said, Miss Cody, I just want to thank you for coming today, and I just loved what you said, and that's just wonderful that you lost all that weight. And then she paused a moment. And I could feel the steam rising from the train that was building its momentum. And she said, so when do you think that skin's going to start shrinking up from losing all that weight? And I was speechless. But there are those who, I guess, think they're building themselves up by cutting other people down. And, okay. So
that sounds like another book to me. How to deal with those sort of people, because I'm almost positive, at least in today's world, and it's both the same for male and females. You have females that can fit into just about anything, and you have females who maybe have come up the ladder through the men's view and act very macho-ish in that sense, and no fun and games here. We're serious to the T, and we go to the gym every day, and this is the time we go, and then you have the ones that are very confused because now their life has changed. So what do I do now? Do I have to start being macho? Do I have to start being more feminine? I mean, what is it that I have to do to deal with all these situations I'm running into? Do you find that kind of grouping when you're out giving talks?
I suppose there is that to a point. I haven't really had to deal with it in a overt way, but I think all women we are our past. We are, that everything that's happened to us, we've had hurts, we've had all kinds of issues that we've had to deal with in the best way we can, and those all come together to make us who we are. And I don't think that it's been an issue for me in dealing one-on-one with women, but I know it's out there. And that's another reason why I try to bring hope and good news through faith. And that is a part of my goal.
Most of the lectures and stuff are they women's groups or are they like faith-based groups?
I'd say two-thirds probably are because I am considered an inspirational humorist. And inspirational, of course, includes Christian and faith-based books and different things. But I have quite a few that aren't, and I love those, too. I enjoy them. I have several different talks. If you go to my website, deborahcody.com, spelled D-E-B-O-R-A, no H, C-O-T-Y, like the perfume, but no money, then I have a list of my topics that you can choose from. And I'm perfectly willing to do whatever I need to do. Some people these days, different organizations and churches don't have a lot of money to put into speakers. They used to fly them across the country, and nowadays people can't do that. So most of my speaking engagements are throughout the state of Florida, Georgia, Alabama, some in Tennessee, mostly in the Southeast. And I try to be as accommodating as I possibly can because I understand how it is.
So while you were talking about Orlando and stuff like that, have you ever spoke at the Northwoods Church?
I haven't.
I have some friends, good friends of mine, who are part of that congregation.
Well, please,
and they've
pass
taken
them
me
my
a
name.
Taken me on a tour of a facility, and I'm just kind of like blown away because it's so huge and so comfortable at the same time. Deborah, let's talk a little bit about the Everyday Hope book. That if I understood you, 40,000?
Yes, isn't that amazing?
Tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, that Everyday Hope is a little devotional that I was asked. My publisher has been Barbour Books, spelled B-A-R-B-O-U-R, for the last four or five of my books. And they asked me to consider doing a little devotional for women. It's in the Spiritual Refreshment for Women series that would be, it's if you could see it, it's just so beautiful. It's got full color floral on every single page, and it's a small book that's purse size, and they consider it a gift book. So I wrote that about a little over a year ago, and so far it has been nominated for several awards, and I'm just so blown away. And it's sold almost 40,000 copies now, and so that's definitely my bestseller, and I'm just thrilled with it.
And I kind of like the idea, because you were saying about in their purse or their bags or whatever, you know, things get a little tough. Starbucks coffee in the book.
Absolutely. And it is very easy to carry around with you, and it's about different topics that are really all needing everyday hope, things that are very, very pertinent to women, choices that we make, burning out, beauty, joy, fatigue, all kinds of different things with family, and well, just tons of stuff that have to do with just about every woman I can think of.
So is there a couple things in there you'd like to read to the listener, maybe that get them going?
I could. I will just kind of randomly flip to one. This one's a little bit sad. Would you like an upbeat one?
You know what? Today's world, I think you could do a sad one. a couple weeks ago, you probably couldn't, but I think that, you know, your choice.
Well, let's do this one. This one's called Stinkin' Thinkin'. It's based on 1 Thessalonians 5:8, which says, "Let us be sober, having put on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet, the hope of salvation." Women's hats aren't as popular as they once were, but you wouldn't know it by my closet. I love accessorizing with a perky hat to make a statement, to disguise a bad hair day, or to keep my brain from sautéing in the sizzling Florida sun. The Bible says we need to protect our minds from bad spiritual rays, too. Nasty input produces nasty output. Stinkin' thinkin'. When we're tempted to input a questionable movie or a book, let's don our salvation helmets and say, "No way."
You know, that's interesting that you said that, because I was thinking back that the most hats I have seen on women was during the royal wedding. I have never seen so many, and every
and
woman...
And they were amazing hats, weren't they?
Creative, let's
like
put it that way.
Flower pots with legs.
Unbelievable. But I was impressed, and I was, you know, my grandmother was in the hats, and I kind of think back a little bit, and I think, what went wrong here? Why did we stop doing
hats? I love
hats. You know, and I've never been able to figure that out.
I'm a hat girl, and I bond with other hat girls. People I don't even know will be standing in the store together looking at hats, and we will be best friends within 5 minutes, and we'll have exchanged email addresses, and yeah, you can bond with them. Here's one about girlfriends from Everyday Hope. It's based on 2 Corinthians 1:7, and our hope for you is firm, because we know that just as you share in our sufferings, so also you share in our comfort. Anne of Green Gables was right. Bosom friends are important. Girls need girlfriends. Little girls and grown-up girls alike. God wired us to need each other, to yearn for the heart bonding that results from shared sufferings, comfort, hugs, and giggles. Nothing's wrong with men, of course, but they don't have the same bosoms. Have you thanked the Lord lately for your soul sisters?
That's pretty good. Now, where would people find this book? I mean, is it available?
Just about everywhere. All of my books are on Amazon.com. Five of them, I think, are e-books now, so you can get them for your Kindles or your Nooks. Christian bookstores carry a lot of them. Barnes & Noble's carry them. But, however, they don't carry all of them, so I usually just say, go to my website, and you'll find them all, which is DeborahCody.com, and you'll also find pages to each of my books that you can click on, and it'll shoot you right over to the Amazon page, and you can purchase them that way.
So, let's go a little bit into the... I know you've done 14 books, so let's take a look at that. How many are related to the subject of Mom Needs Chocolate?
Well, this will be the third one.
Actually,
I have one coming out in August called Too Blessed to Be Stressed, and it's the same type of format, and it's subtitled Inspiration for Climbing Out of Life's Stress Pool, and that will be all about stress. And then I have another one coming out along the same line in the same type of format in March of 2012 called More Beauty, Less Beast, subtitled Transforming Your Inner Ogre. And so those three will be very similar, although Mom Needs Chocolate is hardcover, and the other two will be softcover.
So all of your books that you have, you've had more than one particular subject matter, in the sense of, like, that's kind of leaning toward the women. And do you have it set up so that if I buy one of your books, And that's the only one you ever wrote about that subject.
Not really. I overlap a little bit. Okay. I try not to be repetitive. But, you know, resounding themes are resounding themes for women. And so I do touch on different, some of them, like nutrition and different aspects that kind of come in the room from different doors, I guess, in all of my books, as well as basic issues that we worry, anxiety, dealing with busyness, organizational skills, house cleaning, for instance. And I have titles like Superwoman Has Left the Building, Cobwebs in My Mop Bucket, Romancing the Drone. I even talk about romance. Family Heirlooms, spelled H-E-I-R-L-O-O-N-S, about the craziness that we get in our families. And with my book coming out about stress, Too Blessed to Be Stressed, I, as an occupational therapist that has specialized in orthopedics for over 30 years, I include a lot of stretches and exercises in the book for stress relief that you would pay hundreds of dollars for at your physical therapy clinic that I'm giving you for free right there in the book. And I actually demonstrate them on some videos that are coming out in July. I call them 2-Minute Stress Busters. And they will be coming out. They'll be posted on... all of a sudden, I went blank. On YouTube, of course. They'll be posted on YouTube and on my website. And they're going to be in conjunction. There's 12 of them with some of the tips that are in my book, Too Blessed to Be Stressed.
Let me ask you a serious question here. Do you think that females today are stressed out due to, let's say, television? I mean, not everybody's walking around being desperate housewives. I mean, it seems to me that either they're trying to be something that they're not instead of just living their life, or, you know, they see something and say, I have to be that size, or I have to wear that clothes, or the hats. I mean, the same thing. I have to outdo everybody else with a hat. I mean, do you think that the media is kind of pushing that a little bit too hard in the sense of, you know, you have to be this, or... A normal neighborhood is like the Desperate Housewives, which drives me crazy because you never know what's going on from one week to the other, or things like that. I mean, it seems to me not only there, but we have, there's a new series on Body Double or something like that. It's Dunahy. I can't think of her name, but she's went through some family crisis, and she's a ME now, medical examiner. But it seems like all the shows that have female leads act like they all have issues, which we all do, but they're extremes. I mean, there's Harry's Law, which is, I mean, they make her real, you know, tyrant in a sense when she wants to be. Do you think that is affecting not only the women but family life?
It probably is, and I think the pressures today are extremely strong on women from television, from media. I make that point in Too Blessed to Be Stressed that, you know, mirrors are stupid because they only tell us what we tell them to tell us, and what we know to tell them to tell us comes from the media, comes from magazines, what we see, what we hear from television, from movies. And, you know, the comparisons are just so detrimental to our health. And women, that's second nature to us. That's one of the first things we do when we get a new dress or we get our nails done. We compare ourselves to other people. And I think that can end tragically. You know, you look at the recent, not too long ago, Katie Couric, the little issue with her, with they were trying to trim 10 pounds off of her, you know, photo, and the thing with L'Oreal tried to lighten Beyonce's skin tone for some magazine ads. You know, what is that? The bar has just gotten impossibly high, and we women cannot possibly ever win that battle if these beautiful, lovely ladies aren't good enough. You know, and we just tend to, we compare ourselves without even thinking. And that's one of the tools that I'm trying to cover in my book, Too Blessed to Be Stressed, to try to give women some tools to be able to not have to do that, to be happy with ourselves, and, you know, to cope with that pressure that we get from the world.
Does that come up in a lot of your speaking engagements?
Yes, it's one of the topics that's very, very near and dear to most women, I would say.
Really? Do you find, I mean, let's break down your audience. Is your audience evenly mixed, or do you find that there are more family moms that have a family they go to and kids, or whether you have the single moms, or whether you have the ones that maybe just got divorced.
Is there all of the above. I get asked to divorce groups, and I get asked to single moms. They're MOPS. I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
No.
M-O-P-S, Mothers of Preschoolers. I get a lot of MOPS invitations, and I talk about stuff related to moms there. And when it depends upon the group, and I try to tailor what I'm speaking of to that particular group. So, it's all of the above, and occasionally you'll get everybody together in one place. I just did one about a month ago, and it was a hoot. It was speaking of different people together in one place. It was different cultures together in one place. It was an international women's convention type thing, and we had four languages going at the same time, and that was the first time I had ever been in a situation like that, where the people from one country had their little earphones on, and their interpreter was at the back, which was the male, and I could hear his nice, deep, rumbly bass voice. After everything I would say, he would be speaking in their language. I believe that was Creole, I think. I'm not sure. And then there was another language, and she was just speaking out loud right beside me, and then another language on the other side of the room. So it was like a big gobbledygook. Every time I would make a statement, I would have to pause, and then, of course, you lose your train of thought because you're listening to all this stuff going on, and it was interesting, to say the least. We managed through it, but that was all these different cultures coming together at the same time. And you try to, I do some singing. I do a lot of fun, goofy stuff in my speeches. And at the end, I was trying to have everybody sing this song I wrote. One of the new ones that I wrote is to the tune of America the Beautiful. And it's called Menopause the Attitudeful. And it does not exactly translate into all these languages, but it ended up with most of the women who didn't speak English didn't have a clue, but they had the best time, and they were doing the hip booty shakes, and it was just so fun. And it was just a hoot that you would think, how would that ever work out to sing together? But it did. Somehow, amazingly, it did. Everybody enjoyed it.
So do you have a lot of, like, husbands and males that come to?
I do.
And what are their response? Have you ever had them come up?
Well, sometimes they get a little embarrassed because I do a little girly talk. You know, they say when girls get together, they talk about the three B's, boys, boobs, and babies. So I kind of talk about all three. And occasionally we get a little red face from the men, but most of them afterwards say, now I can understand my wife a little better. And that's cool.
Well, that's always important. And it's great that you have, yourself to be out there, because I think we've had so many different types of things happen. And I don't think people realize whether it's faith-based or whether it's just talking to another sister, another go-girl type thing. And I'm always fascinated because I listen to my daughter, and her attitude is different than my wife's, and it's kind of interesting trying to put together. And they don't see eye to eye too often, so I mean it's kind of interesting that way. But you've done these remarkable books, and it sounds like you're continuing to grow that brand and getting it out there and stuff like that. But you have a couple other books that we can maybe just briefly chat on as we run out of time here. But
okay.
Tell me a little bit about the other books that you've written that are related to
One of the ones that I'm most proud of is called Grit for the Oyster, 250 Pearls of Wisdom for Aspiring Writers. And Grit for the Oyster is based a brainchild of myself and three other gals. Suzanne Woods Fisher is the co-writer, who is now huge. She's awarded up the gazoo, and she's like a best-selling author, and she's doing wonderful. But it was her brainchild to come up with a book that would help brand new aspiring authors, not only with their faith, but with their writing. And so it's a wonderful combination of the devotional, and we had tips from 250 tips, as a matter of fact, from dozens and dozens of successful writers, not just authors, but also publishers and editors. So it's just chock full of great information.
That's
and
great.
I use that, as I mentioned before, I teach a workshop every fall over in Hillsborough County near Tampa. It's called the Florida Inspirational Writers Retreat, and it's on my website if anyone's interested in that. And it's an excellent opportunity to learn how to get your own story out there in print.
That's great. Now, all the books that you have on the website, so they can take a look at
them. They're all on the website, and my two new ones are being uploaded as we speak. So Yes.
So you'll have the two new ones will be out when?
Too Blessed to Be Stressed will be out in August, and it's already on there. And then the next one, I have another gift book coming out called 365 Chick-isms.
Chick-isms.
Chick-isms. That's hard to say, isn't it? And then in March will be the... Oops, I forgot it all of a sudden. More Beauty, Less Beast, Transforming Your Inner Ogre. That'll be out in March. So that's not quite on my website yet, but it will be soon.
So how many executive administrators do you have working for you?
One. And she, bless her little heart, she's running in circles.
I would imagine so. It sounds like you just keep going and going and going. It's not like the Energizer. I guess Energizer Bunnet. Maybe. It's so much fun. Well... I'm hoping that you come back and join us again and tell us about your award you're going
to
win.
Well, thank you, Joe. I hope I have one to tell you about.
Well, I'm almost positive you will. And I think it would be interesting to continue a discussion, maybe even on my program, other than Susan's Authors Connection. Maybe
great.
Have a discussion. People can call in and ask you questions if you're up for
it. Oh, that's awesome.
Now. Okay. Deborah M. Cody has been our guest today, and it's been enlightenment even as a male, let me tell you. But basically, if you're a mom out there, or you're just having some stress, and you're a female, and say, hey, you know what? I've had enough. I think you should check out the website, which is?
www.deborahcody.com, spelled D-E-B-O-R-A, and that's because my mother was so drugged up, she forgot the H when I was born. C-O-T-Y, Cody, like the perfume, .com.
That's great. So we'll expect you back here or somewhere else.
Sounds great.
Okay, good. We'll be right back after a short break.
Do your to-do lists have footnotes? Are you imprisoned by the joy-sucking dully funks? Does your family want to get you a rabies shot because your bark is louder than Rover's? Maybe it's time for a healthy dose of truth, gift-wrapped in humor. I'm Deborah M. Cody, an award-winning author of a book coming out in August of 2011 called Too Blessed to Be Stressed, subtitled Inspiration for Climbing Out of Life's Stress Pool. This is a wonderful offbeat brand of wit and near wisdom for desperate women drowning in the churning stress pool of busyness. Too Blessed to Be Stressed includes simple, practical steps for healing and refreshment of the spirit, body, and faith. And best of all, it has short chapters for on-the-run convenience. Would love to have you join me at my website to find out more about Too Blessed to Be Stressed. And that's www.deborahcody.com. Once again, that's deborahcody.com, spelled D-E-B-O-R-A-C-O-T-Y. This is Deborah M. Cody, award-winning author of Too Blessed to Be Stressed and More Beauty, Less Beast. You're listening to Radio Ear Network.